He turned to the table. "Good night, gentlemen," he said, looking at each of them with the same oddly scornful expression. "I owe about £15,000. I will accept Mayor's addition." He leant forward and picked up his cigarette-case lighter. Then he looked again at Bond and spoke very quietly, the red moustache lifting slowly from the splayed upper teeth. "I should spend the money quickly, Commander Bond."
Welcome to the James Bond Complex. I'm Matt.
I'm Edgar.
Today we are talking about the third book written by Ian Fleming. As previously mentioned in our very first episode, that's my favorite, and that's also your favorite.
At this point, yes. I mean, we still have about a dozen books left to read, but we've now read three of them.
Mm-hmm.
I will continue to argue that this is my preferred one thus far.
Thus far, it is mine too. Although Casino Royale is good. You know what? We'll discuss it when we go through the book, but I feel like Moonraker is Casino Royale 2.0, because there's a lot of plot elements that are very, very similar, but the villain's better and the Bond girl is better too.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I don't know if the villain is better. I do have a big soft spot for Le Chiffre in the book, but I think there's something very entertainingly extravagant about dear Sir Hugo Drax. He's a knight in the book, I think. He's Sir Hugo Drax.
Yes, he is.
So, is he?
He is. We call him Sir.
He's very entertaining. We'll get to reasons why. As for the Bond girl, Gala Brand, I completely agree. I mean, our Bond girls have been getting progressively better. We've gone from Vesper Lynn, who was, and I still remember this to this day, an amorphous blob, to Solitaire, who's interesting.
More a damsel in distress.
Bit of a damsel in distress. I'll agree with you on that. To someone who is, we'll get into it as we go along, but an actual character. This is a character. This is a human being.
Yeah, she does. She well, you mean Gala Brand.
Oh, yes.
She does things. She's competent. So I'll start with my resume.
Please do.
Might take a while, but...
What is this book about?
Monday. Hugo Drax, the Columbite King, an industrialist and self-made millionaire, has built and donated the Moonraker, a nuclear missile capable of reaching the capitals of every country in Europe. On the verge of the weapon's initial test, M, the head of MI6, has discovered something rather unusual about Drax's true nature. He cheats at cards. To avoid a potential scandal and teach the so-called Columbite King a lesson, M arranges for James Bond, secret agent 007, to meet Drax at the Blaze Gentleman's Club for a high-stakes game of bridge. Thanks to his sharp card skills and the influence of Benzedrine, Bond manages to cheat the cheater and beats Drax, earning quite a lot of money. But Drax's last words to Bond sound strange. "Spend the money quickly, Commander Bond." Tuesday. Wednesday. After security officer Valen at the Moonraker project is killed in a bizarre murder-suicide, 007 is dispatched to investigate in order to make sure that the upcoming weapons test is a success. He is greeted by Drax and his cohorts, a creepy group of bald Germans with mustaches, and Gala Brand, a policewoman posing as Drax's secretary. While exploring the project's grounds, Brand and Bond barely survived an attempt made on their life by way of a landslide created by Krebs, one of Drax's men. Thursday, Friday. Growing suspicious of Drax, Gala makes the horrific discovery of the true purpose of the Moonraker's test. It is in fact aimed at the heart of London, armed with a nuclear weapon. After capturing Bond and Brand, Drax proudly reveals his true origins. He is, in fact, a Nazi. He has masqueraded as an English gentleman, gained wealth and influence over his adopted country in order to avenge Germany's loss in World War II. Left to be burned alive by the rocket's exhaust, 007 manages to escape and reprogram the weapon so that it falls in the ocean and destroys the Russian sub that Drax is using to make his escape. After saving England from nuclear Armageddon, Bond expects to spend some quality time with Gala, but ends up alone as she plans to marry her fiancé after going through this horrific ordeal.
now we know what the book is about. This is a really interesting one for a whole bunch of reasons. I mean, James Bond, as we know, is with MI6, that is international espionage. He's not supposed to be operating on home soil. Lo and behold, due to very interesting circumstances, something MI6 somehow suggested someone to work with Hugo Drax in England on the project, but this person is assassinated, as we learned early in the story. Therefore, MI6 still gets to work on this and send James Bond. But the point is, James Bond works in England. He does not set foot outside of the country, which is very inhabitual. It's not going to happen again in the books, I don't think.
I don't think so.
And it's never happened in the
movie. Maybe in the short story. What, maybe
you could be right. Maybe there's a short story I'm forgetting about.
I'm trying to remember. It's been a while. I mean, but I don't think he stays on Bond as much as he does in this novel and any other of the other books.
Yeah. At least it's a nice time of year. It's supposed to be late May, I think.
Yeah, it has to be in the summer months because he goes swimming in
That's true, right. He comments on the food at Blades. Like, oh, English cooking, the best English cooking is the best in the world, especially at this time of year. And I think he says it's May or something, so the vegetables are nice. I like this book a lot. And I think a lot of that has to do, ironically, with the fact that he stays homebound, as you said. It makes it feel a bit more intimate, more immediate. Bond is English. He must save England. I mean, London is in peril in this story, and he does it on home soil. So it does add a bit of a different flavor this time around. It's actually one of the reasons why I like it a lot, actually.
It's not part of the reason why I like this book the most, but it is part of the experience, I guess, in reading this book. It's very Anglo-centric. I like the villain. Like I said, I love Hugo Drax. I find him annoying. I find him obnoxious. And the plot to destroy England and the structure of the book, well, the fact that the villain has a plot to destroy a city feels like something from the movies.
It does. This could, as it is written in the book, this could have been a movie. I think what's really cool about this book as well, I mean, you and I are not English. We've never lived in England, but I think we know our history a little bit, our 20th century history, what happened in World War II, you know, the German bombs going off above London, you know, regularly and various parts in England. It's often been said by scholars, fans, you know, oh, James Bond was the perfect fantasy that the English needed in the post-World War II era when food was being rationed and this and that. So there was a sort of, by reading a Bond book or watching a Bond film, you sort of luxuriated as an Englishman, as a Brit, you luxuriated in something that really, as an ordinary Tom, Dick, and Jane, you probably didn't get to do.
True.
What's fun about this book is that here we have a character in Hugo Drax who is, quote, an English hero, end quote. He gets to live that lifestyle. He is a national icon. This man, thanks to the Moonraker, this beautiful silver bullet, I think, as it's described at one point, this man will go down in history as, clearly, there's no debate, greatest Englishman ever in the history of Englishmen.
He's trying to make England great again.
Absolutely. Very well. I see what you did there. I see what you did there, Matthew.
I'm proud.
So witty. But of course, as you enlightened us in your plot synopsis, and obviously if you've read the book, that's not at all what he's trying to
do.
He's certainly trying to change the course of English history. But I like the fact, very smart of Ian Fleming. Ian Fleming is a clever writer. You take the British psyche at the time, obviously. Mm-hmm. You take that British psyche. You take what that psyche needs: high class living, iconicity, someone people will recognize, someone people can cheer for. This man survived World War II. The poor bastard. We found him in the rubble after an explosion of some sort in Germany. This man is English greatness personified. And then we find out his ulterior, his true motivations.
True nature.
And his true nature, absolutely. I love the fact that Ian Fleming plays on that. I think that is brilliantly diabolical. I love it.
Yeah, that's why there's many reasons why he's my favorite, so far my favorite villain, but He's a Nazi.
Have you watched Inglourious Basterds, people? He's a Nazi.
He's a Nazi. I mean, the only other villain from memory that's probably going to be close to it is probably Blofeld when we get to him. And even then, my heart is set on Drax.
Drax is awesome. You know what? It's going to be interesting reading that Blofeld trilogy because those are the later ones, mm-hmm. and those are the ones I haven't read as often. Much. So I don't remember Blofeld very well from the books. It'll be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah.
We'll cross that bridge when we get to it.
No spoilers yet. So book starts with M. The book starts with Bond going through some type of exercise.
Yeah, interesting way to start the book. I feel that first chapter, Fleming is luxuriating in the technology that's at play. Oh, this flashing light and an image of Bond, and there's a shaft of thin shaft of light over his heart in the image, which indicates that the machine against which Bond was competing, it's a firing range, it's a practice firing range. The machine against which he was competing won, I suppose. I feel it's a fun chapter. It's an interesting way to start the book. I'm not sure what the point is other than, oh, look at the cool shit MI6 has to practice shooting. I don't know.
I love the fact that he mentioned that they kind of bug him about like being shot. They tease him about it. Secretly, he's actually the best shot. Like that's their way of saying, even I think it's Judi Dench in one of the movies that says, oh yeah, I won't tell him, but he's the best agent. So that's why we follow Bond.
In your favorite movie.
Oh, Die Another Day, it's my favorite movie.
Thank you.
It has a lot of similar things to like Moonraker.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that, I mean, logically we're going to review Moonraker, the film, in the next episode, but we kind of could have done a doubleheader, I guess, with Moonraker and Die Another Day.
Yeah, but, oddly enough, but we'll save Die Another Day for another time.
Licking our chops.
We see a lot of things at his office that I like. There's a quote about Mondays. Yeah, and they talk about, it's Monday morning at MI6. Mm. What's their first discussion? Oh, well, this morning we had motor car accidents. We had weekend slaughter, blah, blah, blah. They talk about missions that they had to do during the weekend. Like it's...
There are a lot of neat little details in Moonraker, the book, that I feel, maybe it's because I'm misremembering the other novels, certainly in relation to the two we read recently, Casino Royale and Live and Let Die, Moonraker offers interesting little insights to Bond's job.
Yeah.
He likes going on a mission. He doesn't like spending time in the office reading these files. This Japanese new drug that's on the streets that's getting the kids to commit crime. And Bond stops reading it going, why am I reading this? What is the point? When am I going to use this information? So it's interesting because it enables us to get into Bond's psyche a little bit more. Although we did a little bit in the first two books. But now we really get to understand that this guy likes going on a mission. He's not a desk jockey. And it looks like a boring job when you're not saving the world.
I verified that he's not paid that much. He doesn't make that much money. It comes up later on, but it's not the best paying job ever.
But isn't one of the first few bets he makes at Blades when they start the bridge game, he sort of thinks to himself, oh, crap, I've just bet my year's salary or something like that. One hand.
All details that, I mentioned this. I put that notes into this because it becomes major plot points. Werewolves, German that passed themselves as English people. That was actually a big fear they had. Apparently, it was never actually a real problem, but that was, part of the psychological warfare they were doing. German passing themselves as English. And the Columbite... I was wondering if it's actually a real...
Is that a real thing?
It is a real thing. I wanted to have my sisters... My sister and my brother actually both engineers, so I wanted them read the chapter. I never had the time to make them read, but from the Wikipedia-ing...
You Wikipedia'd it.
It's actually a real thing. It's a real metal. I think it's used to make metal stronger. I don't think it's as rare and hard to find. Well, same thing.
Maybe rare. Not anymore.
Right? Yeah.
Well, I mean, this is from the 50s.
And it's probably not even necessary. They make alloys. They like aluminum is some. It's a metal made by a chemical reaction. So they make their own metals these days. So they don't necessarily need to mine metals all the time, I guess. Those are things I've found amusing.
But again, it furthers the point of Drax being such an awesome guy. I mean, he's a self-made man, which, in many respects, he is a self-made man. But again, it plays up on that the English hero. So many lovely details about that character.
Oh my God! The more you, we will get there when we get there. But
please go ahead.
The more you talk about, he's not a self-made man. He had Russian investors.
He's shrewd.
He's not really a self-made man. We'll get there when we get there. But I think the comment I made earlier points towards my thesis on this character, and it's not it's my interpretation, my 21st interpretation of this character. But yeah, I'll get there when I get there. I love the this chapter where he describes how he was trained to use cards. To shuffle cards, and I made some research. Apparently, he talks about a book, Carney, on cards, and it's actually a real. There are videos of this guy, the guy who wrote that book, and he shows card tricks. It's quite fascinating. Those are like probably 50 years old, and the guy was already in his 50s. But it's fascinating to look at. He's a magician. He's doing card tricks, and so dexterous. I'm like, wow,
sleight of hand, almost. Yeah,
that was fascinating.
Well, I know that chapter also, not only does it give the title and the author of this book, but it provides the names of these tricks as well. I mean, I don't remember them. I'm not much of a card player myself, but this chapter sort of goes on quoting a few of the names, the fancy names, these tricks, these sleight of hand tricks are known as. So, I mean, clearly Fleming knows his stuff. He does his research when he writes these books. I know we're sort of backing up a little bit here, but I do really like the chapter in, I think this is the third consecutive book where the second chapter is the M scene, or the M office scene, because we get more of M.
But
this
is the first that is, it's in
sequential order.
Thank you.
Chronological order of the events. Yeah.
This is the first one that follows that when we go to baby.
Yeah, because in the first two books, the M scene is a flashback, I think. Yeah. But what I like is the very subtle, relaxed atmosphere between M and Bond this time around. In fact, Bond actually gets a little bit worried at first when his superior addresses him as James, I believe.
Yeah.
That gets him sweaty, which in of itself is pretty funny. It says a lot about the kind of relationship they have. So I thought it's a very different M office scene. And it was extremely entertaining for it. I like the fact that Fleming decides to branch out. And we get more of M, too, because we see M for another two or three chapters, because they're going to challenge Drax at Bridge.
Yeah, we see him in public life, which I found fascinating, because they censor his name when he names himself. I thought it was very cute. You know, Bond at one point orders a Chateau Mouton Rothschild, and they don't mention the price of the bottle, but I was curious. So I did two things. I checked the price of what that bottle would be. I checked the time, because I think I don't remember the date, but it's like about 10, 15 years old. So I put the equivalency of that particular bottle, what it would be if it was that old. Mm-hmm. It would be, if based on my assumption today, around $400 for a bottle of Mouton Rothschild.
Mouton Rothschild.
Yeah, from 1999. And I checked also for a bottle from that era. I think it's close to $1,000. So I'm not buying you one.
It's not my birthday. So basically what you're saying is Bond and M enjoyed themselves. I know M doesn't take it, I don't think. Bond only has it, does he not?
Yeah.
M is a little bit
Bond
more worried
gets wasted and... He doesn't
and
just
high to us to agree.
Oh my God! Verify after that. Amphetamines are close to what's the drugs that there's a term, there's an epidemic of that drug.
Oh, opioid.
It's called,
we don't know what it is in English.
Opioid.
Opioids.
Opioids. It's close.
Painkiller, right?
Yeah. It's close. It's similar. From what the reading, it's not very far from it, but it's almost like cocaine, basically. One of the ways that I heard that you can actually make amphetamines is to cut cocaine.
Really?
Another fascinating thing, which I discovered on the documentary, it's on Netflix. I don't remember what's the name of the documentary, but it's on World War II, and they talk about how World War II was won. And one of the things that was used to win World War II was drugs. Most of the drugs that are being dealt today were first used by soldiers in World War II. It's fascinating. Like cocaine, like Captain America was on cocaine.
He's hooked on cocaine. Huh? A hell of a drug, that cocaine. It's not something you would think of just off the cuff, but learning it isn't particularly surprising. I mean, when you're at war, you're battered, you're bruised, you're psychologically beaten as well. So yeah, I guess you would give soldiers some sort of a stimulus, if you would call it that. So
take
I guess
edge off.
In a perverse way, that kind of makes sense.
Well, it's fascinating. Who were the first drug dealers? Hells Angels.
The generals and the colonels.
No, but who were the Hells Angels at the beginning? There were former soldiers that came back from the war, and they had the first taste, and they started giving it away, I guess. I don't know.
So they did it the Kanango way, where they give a little bit for free, and then they jack up the price.
So that's my take on drugs.
Very interesting take. I mean, you obviously read up much more on this topic than myself. But what you're saying sounds like it makes a lot of sense to me.
And what's his name? Lashif does benzodrin in the first book.
I think he does. Yeah,
he does it by an inhaler. Bond takes a. It sounds such like a 70s. The way that describe how he does, benzodrin, he just takes a powder and dumps it in his drinks. I'm like,
it's tasteless, right? Odorless and tasteless. Because he puts it in the champagne, which annoys M. Like, M thinks the pepper in the vodka is kind of interesting, but the benzodrin in the champagne annoys M. He says, oh, don't worry, it doesn't taste anything.
Yeah, so.
And he argues that he'll need that. He needs his wits about him this evening. And he needs to act
like a drunk.
And he needs a little bit of overconfidence. And I think we get a bit of both as the chapter goes along. Especially the overconfidence, going back to that, I've bet my year's salary. What the hell am I doing?
I don't understand Bridge. Honestly, it kind of bored me, but at the same time, I love that part for the dialogue.
Yeah.
And the intensity.
There's a lot of character development through dialogue and physical descriptions, particularly Drax. We do get to, obviously his true identity is revealed much later, but just as a personality, we do learn a lot about him in this chapter. He's very fidgety. He's a stressed out man.
He's very acerbic.
Competitive.
Mm-hmm.
There's this, I remember, because actually on the way over to meet you earlier today, I was reading a few passages myself, and I like it when Bond and M are having dinner. This is before the bridge game. They're at Blades, they're having dinner, and Bond makes a remark. You know, he goes on, he says, he's very successful. He's a bit of a dick, but he's successful. But, you know, there is something funny about him, the jokes. There's no lightness of touch about them. You know, put that in your pipe and smoke it. Apparently, he says that with a bit of viciousness to it. Like, there's nothing delicate about this.
Yeah, he's a braggart. He reminds me of somebody that has a similar
who could you be talking
attitude.
About?
I don't know. He might be a politician.
We're not political at the James Bond Complex.
No. I'm sorry.
But fair point, nevertheless. He is of that, we won't name, but he is of that personality.
Yeah.
Very much so, actually. He's an industrialist as opposed to a politician, but you could definitely swap those two professions, and Hugo Drax would fit right in with, where you-know-who is right now. So.
Yeah. That's terrifying. I liked him because he's a bit of an ass.
Oh, he's fun. And again, third book in a row, Ian Fleming's descriptions of the character's physicality, love it. The red hair, the different scars. Eyes, the scars, the different eyes. The right eye is like, larger than this than like, the left eye.
Kind of like
yeah. No, he's he. I mean, in if there's only one thing we would defend Hugo Drax on, he is a victim of wartime. So you know he required plastic surgery to recover to the best of his physical abilities, I suppose. So he needed plastic. He required plastic surgery, but the results were the guy's alive, but aesthetically, the results were questionable.
Yeah,
let's say it that way. I love that. I love it. I love Hugo Drax. I love you, man. I don't love you, but I love you.
I love hating you.
Oh, exactly. Thank you. Thank you. I love hating you. There's hate, and then there's I hate you, but then I enjoy hating you.
No, he's charming. Yeah, in his own way, he's kind of charming. It's like, oh, you're such a dick, but.
And we find out that he is a cheater.
He is.
That's the little bastard. He uses a silver, very shiny, very pristine cigarette case. I think. Yeah. And when he's dealing the car once every four deals, when it's his turn to deal, he subtly, I believe most card players do, that you know, you look downwards when you're dealing the cards, but he has the cigarette case so he can see the cards he's dealing, and he has a great memory. So the cheat.
Yeah. And Bond tricks his own deck of cards and manages to cheat the cheater.
Can I stop you for a moment and ask you a question?
Yes.
Do you fully comprehend how? I mean, I get he took 10 minutes after supper to play with the cards. Do you understand what he did?
No.
I don't understand what he did.
I think no. Actually, I have to remember because he talks about.
There's even a picture of their hands. Oh, like Joseph. Okay, but
you know, I listened to the audiobook version, and that probably made it even more uncomprehensible.
Unlike Casino Royale, unlike to an extent Live and Die, I feel Moonraker feels like the first time where Fleming spends a bit of time in a female character's head. Mm-hmm. We are with Gallibrand for a few passages, and like Bond's not around. He's not there. So I kind of thought that was an interesting. I hadn't read Moonraker in a bit, so I had forgotten that he did that. And he makes her, you know, I think we were constantly waxing poetic about Ian Fleming. I'm sure he doesn't need any more praise than we have already given, but I kind of respect that. Like, I don't know how many authors would have done that to not just include a major female, strong female character like that, but to actually get into her head at a time, early, mid-50s, where would a lot of authors think of doing that? Maybe I'm being too
I don't know.
Generalized. It's, I don't know, but I thought that was kind
of
cool.
It's Fleming. You don't expect it from Fleming. It's probably more because of the author.
Probably, yeah.
He's a known. He's a.
He's a sexist, misogynist dinosaur. And a racist and a homophobe. Yeah.
And we love him because of that.
Pretty
if
much.
If they made Bond, James Bond, a nice guy, really respectful. He doesn't smoke. He doesn't swear. He goes to church.
Family man.
A family man.
Family values.
Family values. Well, it's not the character, and I don't care about that guy. I like my Bond.
Make him dirty. Make him dirty.
Self-destructive is the term I'd like to use.
But
to go back to the book.
Yeah, I and Gallibrand herself is really, really cool because she's.
And even Bond's impressed by her. Bond, when he assesses her, he's like, oh, well, she could probably break my arm if she wanted to. Mm-hmm, like, he recognizes her as somebody of talent. He's not, like, he respects her as a policewoman.
I think that's a big moment in the book when Bond figures out that he's working with someone
that has his back.
Has his back, and if need be, she's going to take care of her business, even if Bond's not around. You know, if Bond is impressed by this character, we should probably be impressed by this character too. You know,
but by proxy, we are. That's by design. That's why you wrote it this way, and it's brilliant. I mean, she's the first, and I understand why they didn't use the name Gallibrand, but the character in what's her name that Rosamund Pike plays in Diary Day is meant to be Gallibrand, but for obvious reason, they never used that character officially, unofficially they did, but I think there's a respect for that character. That's why they're like, you know what, we're keeping her. We'll pull her in on cold ice, but eventually we'll get to her because she's great.
Hopefully.
I love her. Like,
she's a lot of fun, and she's very, she feels real. Maybe, certainly unlike, unfortunately, Vesper, our dear beloved Vesper. And even though Solitaire, we liked her a bit more.
Solitaire feels like a fantasy character.
To a large degree, yeah, I would agree with that. Galabrand, she feels real. She's in a man's way. She seems to be the only woman. She is the only woman in the book, but in this compound.
In the compound, yes.
So she's, you know, living in a man's world, quite literally. But despite that, yes, she is professional and taciturn when working, I'm using quotation marks, working with Drax. When she's not around Drax, such as the beach scene when they're investigating before the disaster strikes, she has some personality about her. She can let her guard down, and that's not a problem. That's who she is. She's tough when she needs to be tough, and she's very nice and cute when she needs to be nice and cute. She feels real. Nothing's forced.
And there's moments where Bond forces a kiss on her, and she
doesn't like it at first.
She doesn't like it, and she tries to get him, and they have a nice interaction. It feels...
It's fun. The flower joke, yeah. You know, you pick a flower and it screams.
Actually, that's based on the, like, the scientist he mentions is actually real. I love those kinds of details.
I know you do. That's why, listen, I don't know if I'm sure I've said this because we're at episode 7 at this point. Matthew comes prepared. I wing it. That's how we do it at the James Bond Complex.
What's part of the charm?
I know you will do the research. Drax and Krebs have known each other since the war. They haven't known Walter since the war. Walter is sort of not the third wheel. He's the scientist. They need him, but he's more new to that team than I think Krebs is.
Oh, man. I want to talk about Krebs.
Do you?
Oh, God. I love them. I love them. The description of them, the way...
Seems kind of dopey.
Yeah, but he's like... He's great. This is like,
please, why?
And just, I love the description
because
they compare him. Oh, and he's such annoying because he's like slap happy when Bond's car crash. He's slap happy. Mm. They used, like, I was picturing Peter Lorre, a young Peter Lorre, and ironically, coincidences, Peter Lorre played Le Chief in the 1950 TV version of Casino Royale.
Bit of a blow that we, yeah, Matthew's like the, showing me a nice
like thing. The eyes are widespread apart, yeah, the
pasty skin,
yeah, kind of Weasley, with the mustache and baldness. Like, just the fact there are a bunch of bald Germans with mustaches, it reminded me of another movie, not Moonraker, not Die Another Day, actually, The World Is Not Enough. Because if you remember in that movie, all the Renard henchmen are bald dudes that look exactly like each other.
And I like it. I'm going with it. I'm following you, brother.
But it's a cool concept. It's creepy a little bit. It's like...
It's a little too ostentatious. Drax makes an attempt to explain it at the end, but I'm like, that's still too ostentatious, bruh. Bruh. You could have not done that, you know. But anyways, though, those crazy Nazis and their ideas.
Yeah, you can't explain them. So I liked a lot of references to art in this book.
Especially at Blades. Yeah, especially at Blades.
Even when he describes Galabrand, that's the paint, the Marie Laurencin painting. I think that's the I'm showing Edgar a picture.
That's Galabrand.
No, it's the other one, the one on the
not
left.
The dog.
Not the dog.
Oh, okay.
I think that's what she meant, but that painter does very impressionist. They're not very realistic, but you give an impression of the person.
So romantic.
Yeah.
But romantic in that classical sort of literary sense, where it's like it's emotional, it's beautiful, not necessarily heartstring pulling romance, but
and even at Blades, I don't know. I went to the website of the actual club that inspired it, and it's you have to be a member. It's really like secret.
But high society, high rollers.
It looks like a place. I think it didn't print.
Where dreams come true.
No, but it looks like a place that probably still smells of cigars and cognac that were drank and smoked about 100 years
during
ago.
During Moonraker the book.
Yeah, during Moonraker the book.
I loved, actually, before I left home today, I as I said, I permitted myself to reread a few passages of the book. One of the ones I reread was a couple paragraphs in which Fleming offers a visual, splendorous visual description of what the place looks like, and the Hellfire Club, and this painting, and that painting, and frizzels, or what do they call those? Stone, and in the stone figures are carved friezes. I can't remember what it's called. Adams, fireplaces, and this and that. The pièce de résistance, the little gas jet on the wall inside a cage. That's great. I love that. I love blades. I'd like to walk in.
I'd love to go. It's those old dead gentlemen clubs are a little bit creepy in the 21st century because they're very misogynistic.
And I don't smoke. But I'll puff a cigarette if I can light it up with the gas jet on the wall.
Well, I love myself a cigar every once in a while. Also, I love another reference. He talks about the compound. He compares it to a Dali painting. And
he does.
I think that's the one with the melting clocks. I think that's the one he makes.
Yeah, because he describes a vast horizon with something sticking out. Although there are a few. I've seen this before, the melting. This is one of his, I think, more famous, more well-known Dalis. Do you think that's the one? I don't know Dali well enough to know if that's the one.
But. I think that's the one they describe, the dessert. The
persistence of memory is its name.
I think that's the one. The beginning is great with the bridge game.
Fucking awesome.
But there's all huge chunks where nothing happens.
Okay, go ahead. I'll let you elaborate on that.
Not that nothing happens, but it's a lot of explaining, a lot of meet characters, blah, blah, blah. The way that the book is set up, there's no surprises. It's like Columbo. You know, when your lead, the bad guy is named Hugo Drax, you don't think you know he's going to be a bad guy at one point. It's just no surprise. There's no like surprise when it's revealed that he has a desperately plan to destroy London.
I can't call you out and say you're wrong. That said, despite the fact that this was not the first time I read the book, I kind of enjoyed those scenes where Bond is in his room late at night looking at the charts of the land and the fingerprints on the charts of the notes, and he's trying to
add it together,
and he can't seem to add it all together. Yes, in the back of our minds, Hugo Drax is clearly the antagonist. When and how that will be revealed, we don't know at this point. But I do like it's kind of a detective story.
It's a by way of Columbo, you know.
Just one more thing.
It's not negative. Well, it is and it isn't. It builds characters, but there's no real surprise.
No,
you know where you're going, but I mean, it's like a Bond movie. You know what you're gonna get when you watch a Bond movie. There's, if you want to be honest, it's a recipe, but it tastes so different every time.
You know what it's like? It's like From Russia with Love. The bad guys are introduced. Who they are, what they want to do, how they're going to do it at the start of the movie, and then we follow Bond. We know the trap Bond is going into. How's he going to escape it? Was it a little bit like that?
Actually, you're right. Mentioned this way, you're right. Because I like, as soon as the first attempt on their life is made, the first serious attempt with the landslide.
Yeah.
The book like lights up. It becomes like,
oh yeah,
because when they get the landslide dropped on them, not only are they have to recover and like look like nothing happened.
Yeah, I like that. I like that they wash up, they put their clothes on, they dry their clothes, then they go to the little inn that's outside of town, and they come back.
And they underneath their clothes, they're
all tattered. They're completely battered and bruised. Worse, maybe.
They're beaten.
The description of their physical pain. Maybe that's a passage where we spend less time with sort of Gallibrand and more with Bond, but the description of the physicality and the pain they're experiencing to dislodge those rocks that are above them is incredible.
Yeah.
It reads like it hurts like all hell.
And even when the way that it's described, the explosion, when he, because it's an explosion, he's saying something, and he describes how they were buried. And like, I know you mentioned previously that you love the way that explosions are described in the books, and
yeah, I love explosions.
This was amazing. This was great.
Notice is a bird.
Yeah.
And the bird flies off, and in that instant, he sort of realizes, what the hell's going on? Boom, explosion happens, and then he wakes up under, I guess, a bunch of rubble. Not enough to have crushed them, although it comes frighteningly close to crushing them. Yeah, it's... I do like me some Ian Fleming.
Boom, boom.
I like some boom, boom when it's in a Fleming book.
It's particularly well... It's written from the perspective of, I'm assuming, probably somebody who experienced something like that. Yeah.
Again, it's what I like about those descriptions, although I still like how the boat blows up in Live and Let Die a little bit more, but the descriptions are, you took the words out of my mouth. It's someone who's there. You don't know an explosion is happening. You're just hearing sharp sounds and seeing...
I'm blasted.
Yeah, you're just experiencing it, and that's how he describes it. You can figure it's an explosion. Ian Fleming isn't telling you the wall exploded. He's saying, suddenly the sky became white as snow, and a bell rung thunderously in Bond's ear. But even 10 times better than what I'm doing now. Oh, this is an explosion. This is what you feel and sound and hear when there's
an explosion. You don't understand it when it's happening, but... particular the way he described
it. It's very colorful, very vivid. It's very, very vivid. It's very visceral.
And I think we're going to talk about the third part because we're almost an hour in.
If you couldn't tell, we're enjoying the book.
Yeah, I really love this book. That's the car that he's driving. It's a Mercedes Type 300S. They are ones that are roofless and convertible. Some are not convertible. I'm going to assume he probably has a convertible because it...
What was funny, as I reread it this time, late in the story when they're coming back from London and he's giving chase to Hugo Drax, suddenly, like Fleming says, and Bond took out the goggles from his compartment to... And I'm like, wait a minute, there's no roof on this car? I hadn't clued in that it was a car without a roof.
Man, it's an old... Well, Bond's car is outdated. I think it's 20 years old when in 1950s.
Yeah, there's a book from the 50s, and in the 50s, his car is 20 years old.
Yeah, no, it's completely outdated. It looks... It's silly for me to think about somebody driving with goggles, but probably people still did that type of driving at the time, I guess. But in 2017... Does he? I think he drives an Aston Martin in one of the books. I'm not entirely certain, but he changes car eventually.
It would have to be some of the later ones. Not even Dr. No or For Much Love. Once Goldfinger became popular.
I think it's in Goldfinger. I'm not entirely certain, but yeah.
That'd be kind of like Goldfinger is 64.
The book is 57 or 58.
Huh. I guess we'll find out when we get to that book. I don't remember him driving an Aston. I'll take your word for it.
I'm not entirely certain. But,
This is a Bentley, right? It's a Bentley.
It's a Bentley.
Yeah.
I love Krebs with Gala because he's so creepy. He's so lecherous. He's so slimy.
I know. It's awesome.
He's such a creep. And the mustache and the baldness. And it just creates... this guy's a pervert.
Perfect, and he's described in a way that he doesn't strike me as a particularly healthy person physically. He probably doesn't smell very good. His breath probably smells terrible. He's described as though he hasn't taken a shower. Although Fummy doesn't say that, he strikes me as someone who hasn't bathed in like a month.
He feels slimy.
Yeah, oily,
oily, like ugh.
Our skins naturally produce oil. This guy's got a little too much oil on him. You know?
It's got a lot of leftovers from the 40s.
From the war.
And, oh, the monologuing. I'm almost tempted to do the entire,
Hugo's?
Yeah, but it's way too long.
A pleasant interlude, my dear Bond, during which I was able to bring many an Englishman to book, which, Drax beamed coldly at Bond, gave me much pleasure. Love it. I love you, Hugo Drax.
He's got such great lines. He's such a...
He sounds like a movie Bond villain. Yes. He sounds like a movie Bond villain.
Yeah. He's great. Honestly, I don't know which Bond I was picturing, but when he finishes his speech and he's trying to impress Bond, and Bond basically mocks him and calls him, oh, you're doing this because you're bullied in school, and you're just sucking your thumbs.
Stop sucking your thumb, you big baby.
I don't know which Bond, part of me was like, oh, Roger would have been fine.
Yep.
Roger, at the same time, Sean could have had attitude, but not as funny.
Well, what about in Dr. No when they're at the dinner table and he says, tell me, does the toppling of U.S. rockets really make up with the loftier
right.
hands?
You're right.
I love that line.
You're right, but that's a great comeback. And he gets what he wanted. He wants to. And I realize that Bond does that often. He pisses the villain off just enough to get him distracted and get the advantage some way.
And going back to what that means for a character like James Bond,
mm-hmm.
is the fact that at the end of the day, he's saving as many lives as he can. So you have, I don't want to call him a blunt instrument because that would be too base, it'd be too gross. He's better than a blunt instrument, but...
The hero that we want, but the hero we deserve. Thank you, Batman.
Thank you. Fate to Black credits, Hans Zimmer booming it out, rocking it out. No, but you're right. I mean, I know you gave a quote from The Dark Knight,
but
it applies to Bond. Yeah. He's not a nice man,
no.
but he's doing the right thing.
Yeah, he's the devil that does the work of the angels, basically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Not no, because an angel doing no. Yeah, yeah. He's a devil doing the work of the angels. Yeah, he's a effing asshole that is doing what needs to be done so that you and I can go back to our respective homes at night and make ourselves a nice dinner and sleep soundly at night.
Yeah.
But he's being a complete dick about
it. Yeah, he's enjoying it too much. But he's also a little bit self-destructive, which is something
smoking and the drinking. And
he's trying to...
And he needs the adrenaline. I mean, it makes it quite clear that he doesn't care about these files that he has to study his office. He wants the next mission to come along.
He wants to. So back to... he gets Drax to leave them alone in... His personal office.
Yeah, the office is below ground, located very close to where the Runewrecker rocket itself is.
And this was the object that perplexed me the most, the desk slider.
Oh, right. Because I couldn't figure out...
I couldn't figure out what it was, so I had to Google it. It's a Ronson desk slider. I recommend that everyone listening to this Googles it, because it's a gorgeous object. It looks fancy. It looks very Art Deco.
Looks like I would have almost mistaken it for a cappuccino maker.
But it looks, you remember the '90s Batman cartoons?
Mm-hmm.
Everything's Art Deco in that cartoon, right. So it feels like a Batman gadget.
From okay,
that cartoon.
okay, all right.
I could see Batman using that, and batarangs come out of it or something. But he manages to use that lighter that. Drax forgot in his office that when he left Bond and Gala, and he relights a torch they were planning to use to burn
Krebs was going to torch them information. They're smart about it. They give the information they think Drax wants immediately. Therefore, Krebs doesn't get to torture them. But they leave. Because he's distracted, Drax, with the insult you alluded to, he leaves this lighter, which enables them to melt, burn or melt the cords that are holding, mm-hmm. holding them to these chairs. And what do you think of the climax, by the way? Because there's not a lot left in the book. There's barely 30 pages here at this point left in the book. It's interesting. It's not like action-packed.
There's a classic Bond gets tortured scene when he gets the hosed and burned.
Steam hose.
It's a great scene, the way it's described. And they're like they're escaping through some pipes, and to chase them, they use the steam, and they brace themselves, and they get tortured, they get burnt.
And because of the prior day's incident, they're already a little battered and bruised to begin with. So,
but they get even worse. But they manage to survive, and the entire accomplice gets abandoned because they're escaping right now, because they know they're gonna be persona non grata once they blow up London. So they leave Bond and Gallo thinking they're dead, and Bond manages to reprogram
with Gala's great assistance, because she knows the numbers.
he reprograms the Moonraker so that instead of destroying London, it lands somewhere in the ocean on top of coincidentally, because that's something that's not meant to be. It's just a coincidence.
Yeah, it's a bit of a funny... Two things about that. The funny coincidence that, oh, gee, it also landed on the submarine Drax was escaping in. And is it just me or the passage? There's another chapter after this. Another M scene. We got three M scenes here. So there's a debriefing. Mm-hmm. A mission debriefing. And M says something like, oh, yeah, nuclear fallout at Blue North. I guess that's the way people thought in the 50s.
Yeah, but even, we'll get there when we get there, but there's something, I've watched the documentary on the making of, and they talk about the Moonraker weapon as just a small rocket. And in 2017, that plot, that nuclear missile is more terrifying than somebody trying to blow up
plot. Why would that not work in 2017? It's a great plot.
Why didn't it work? Well, it didn't work for them in 1979.
Because of your favorite movie franchise of all time. That's why it
didn't work. Yeah, I know. Yeah, the book ends rather differently than any other Bond book before and since.
Well, Majesties and Only Live Twice come to mind as weird endings.
Yes, they're different, but he doesn't get the girl.
Well, he doesn't get the girl in Casino Royale either.
Well, he consumes the girl. Let's just say he has sex with her.
True dat.
And for Bond, it's it feels like I'm just gonna go home and take care of myself, basically.
I think he has to shut it off. I think he's not in love with Gala. This isn't another Vesper Lind in his life, but he really legitimately appreciated her.
I've read more on her apparently in the continuation novels. He kept in touch with her. Yeah, no, I was fascinated.
Interesting.
He sends her Christmas cards, apparently.
Awesome. Really?
He kept in touch.
Oh, that's awesome. I like apparently that.
She had a couple of kids, and she's still married, but they kept in touch and thought, maybe if he retires and she's suddenly single, hey, who knows? She's my favorite Bond girl so far. Like the one. Yeah,
well, we know it's. I don't want to say it's slim pickings, but kind of. Yeah, she's at the top, and I think, you know, there are many more books to go through, there will be other challengers to the number one spot, but I think Gala will be number one for a while. Mm-hmm. I think she'll be number one for a while, at least for a few books.
I forgot to do a section that I love doing. I'll go through it very quickly because I love just giving a flavor of where people were at the time. So I'm just going to go quickly through the year of 1955. So January 17th, the USS Nautilus, the first nuclear-powered submarine, put to sea for the first time. Also, James Bond actor Rowan Atkinson, January 6, 1955, is born. He played
James Bond actor Rowan Atkinson.
Yeah, he played the MI6 contact in Never Say Never Again.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, John Grisham was born in February of that year. Bruce Willis, March. Marina Sirtis and Bruce Willis were both born in March. They're the same age. And Marina Sirtis, well, Consular Troy from Star Trek Next Generation, she feels much younger than Bruce Willis.
Yeah,
like to me, she's still what in her 40s, but she's probably what like her 60s now.
But I won't complain.
Oh,
woman's looking good.
Jim Henson builds the first version of Kermit the Frog.
Wow, in 1955.
Yeah. Prototype, I'm guessing. God. Oh, and for Montreal or Montreal listenership and friends, I guess, March 17, 1955, it's the Richard Riot in Montreal. 6,000 people, protested the suspension of Maurice Richard at the time after an altercation during a match where...
La Raquette
Richard... April, Winston Churchill resigns as Prime Minister. Ray Kroc opened his first McDonald's in April 15th, 1955. The first McDonald's. Kate Mulgrew of Star Trek fame is also born. So is Bill Paxton in May. Lady and the Tramp is the 15th animated film. It premieres June 16th. Disneyland opens on July 17th. The first edition of the Guinness Book Records published in August 27th. Other things.
You went through the entire calendar.
Oh, Tanya Roberts is born in October 15th. My James!
You mean James Bond actress Tanya Roberts?
Yeah, from A View to a Kill. James Dean dies in the... in that year, I don't know where. September 30th is film Rebel Without a Cause is released posthumously on October 27th.
Have you ever seen that movie?
No, I've never.
It's so good.
And the Vietnam War begins between South Vietnamese Army and the North Vietnamese Army. And that I found fascinating. General Motors becomes the first American corporation to make a profit of over $1 billion in 1955. 1955. I'll have to verify, but a billion in 1955 is probably like more money than is actually available right now. And our favorite section, the leftovers. There's a lot of things that are left in that novel.
That don't make it to the movie.
A lot did make it to the movie, but
subtly.
Parts of it were
like the Ministry of Defense in Venice. Don't insult me, Bond. I play bridge with this guy. Like, okay. There's the bridge game for you.
Krebs is my must. That like my MP, MPV.
MVP.
MVP.
Most valuable player.
My MVP.
Valuable prick.
Yeah, I want to see him in a movie. He'd be great as the slimy, like too slimy to even fight. Like he punches him, and
he's in Moonraker, the movie. He's the guy controlling the gondola. You know, the in Rigen. That's Krebs.
Yeah, we'll get there. Krebs is not there's a proxy for Krebs, but that's not him. Galabran has to be used in a movie. Like she's parts of her were used notions. Because
Hollywood works for Drax. She's also playing for the good guys behind. Like, it's sort of Galabrand, but not so much.
Not so much. There's a little bit in the movie, in the book. There's a part in the book, and it's not something they can use for an action sequence. It's just a visual. After he's won the game, he's driving and he looks at a sign that blinks, and for a second he's like, "What the?" And it says, "Summer Shell is here," but for a second, he just sees Hell is here. Mm. It's been used in another movie that neon sign that turns into Hell is here. It's not the movie that you're expecting it to be, but I wish they'd use it in a movie. But I'll show you, because kept the notes away from you for exactly this reason.
What's coming up here? What? Oh, my God.
It's in Batman Returns.
God. Oh, my God.
Hal is here. But it just says Hal here. Because initially our sign, in Batman Returns, Selina Kyle goes into his transformation, but she becomes Catwoman after being bitten by radioactive cats. When she goes home and makes her costume, she has...
Did you say radioactive cats?
Yeah. she has, for some reason, a neon sign that says, hello here, hello there, and she comes on. She breaks the T and the O, so it becomes Hal here.
It's like the two greatest things ever created by humankind combined together, Bond and Batman. Batman.
But I think it doesn't work for... It's just a weird thing in Batman Returns. But in the context of the movie, because it creates a creepy impression. I don't know. It creeped me out.
It is. It is.
It's a simple thing.
Something bad is on the horizon.
Exactly.
Something's amiss.
I wish... They could use that in the movie. It's a visual, so I don't see why they couldn't use that.
You just imagine Bond 25, you know, Daniel Craig, DC, my boy. You know, he's driving off to Blades and Hell is here. And that intense stare he has just, or something.
Mm, yeah. Grumbles.
That would be...
So, final thoughts?
I love this story. I've always loved it for the villain, for the location, for the Bond girl, for the Moonraker itself, mm-hmm. for the themes that were prescient at the time and to an extent are still prescient today. I think it's a great adventure. I love the, at this point, you could say Tarantino-esque Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Tarantino does that in every one of his movies these days, like these chapters, these sections. Mm-hmm. I like that a lot. Yeah, it's extremely entertaining. I think it is the most, from characterization of Bond, Bond girl, villain, and plot, I think it's the most fulfilling book we've read so far.
Yeah.
The other ones have their qualities, but this one feels like the fullest piece. Fleming has truly found his rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
Everything has come together. Every single one of the main or supporting players make sense and they're great, whereas in the other books we always had, whether they were major qualms or smaller qualms, we still had our qualms. I just don't have any in this book.
Final thoughts as for myself. I love this book. It's my favorite. I'm worried that things aren't going to go down from here. I'll be honest. I'm a little bit worried because the next one is not, I've confessed, it's not my favorite one.
I have said that, yeah.
I'll try to have an open mind. Even the movie is not my favorite. I'll try. It's weird. It's going to be our fourth...
Shit, that's true. That's the next movie we got to watch.
Yeah. It's going to be our fourth film, and oddly enough, it's the first one that we're going to cover that features Sean Connery as James Bond.
And we've had a Daniel and two Rogers.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think in England, a Roger means something different. I shouldn't have put it that way.
But it's going to be a strange one. But Moonraker, the book, is great. The best villain so far, the best Bond girl, a crazy plot. It's what you expect from a Bond movie. So if it's your first time reading a Bond novel, I would actually recommend this one as your first one.
Yeah. I think a lot of people would be tempted to say either Casino Royale or maybe Goldfinger, because Goldfinger, the film, is so wildly heralded as the best one or among the best ones. But yeah, if you want a good book with a really good story and characters, I'm going to agree with you. I'd start with Moonraker.
Start with Moonraker. Yeah. All right. So it's a wrap. Where can people find us? Very quickly.
Oh, many places. We have a Twitter account at the Bond Complex. We have a Facebook group page, the James Bond Complex on Facebook. Just search the James Bond Complex.
I've launched an Instagram account, the James Bond Complex on Instagram.
Yeah, I'm using you're using the Twitter a little bit.
Not as
I'm
much
using
as
it
will.
Quite a bit. The Twitter, sure, we're on Instagram. Clearly, I've not been using it. I don't even know how to log in. I'm not the biggest Instagram guy, so I'll let... You can.
I'll
that
be
can
enjoyed.
Be your baby. That can be your baby. I'm at on Twitter predominantly at @OOH_POP.
I'm at Matt O'Claire. That simple. So I guess that's it for this episode. So what's next for us?
Well, just like James Bond himself, the James Bond complex will return in Moonraker circa 1979.
À la prochaine.
Au revoir.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.